While the Ottoman Empire lost to the Allies in World War I, the Turkish Republic that emerged afterward is a fascinating place today, where you can walk among many layers of world history. A stroll around some of its rural villages might even make you feel as if you've also traveled back in time. A Turkish guide answers listener calls about visiting the villages of Turkey a little later this hour on Travel with Rick Steves. Right now, Michael Korda is our special guest. He's editor-in-chief emeritus at Simon & Schuster and has written some 20 books of his own. His latest provides an intimate view of the First World War through the poems some of its soldiers wrote about what they saw and experienced. It's called Muse of Fire. In your book, Michael, we meet these poets. We see photographs of them. We read their poetry and the story behind it. And we learn of their romantic lives, and romantic not in a kissy, mushy, junior high kind of way, but romantic meaning in the dramatic struggles of nations against nations and battles of attrition. And you get these poetic people in the trenches, and you bring them to life in your book. Now, we've talked about Robert Brooke. We've talked about Alan Seeger. Let's talk about Isaac Rosenberg.
Isaac Rosenberg fascinated me. I included him and Alan Seeger, two people who had served in the ranks in the war. Most of my soldier poets were officers, and I needed people who had served as common soldiers. Rosenberg is quite fascinating because his parents came out of Russia in the years when Jews were only allowed to live in the Pale of Russia, which is the westernmost area of Russia that now comprises Poland, Belarus, and the western part of the Ukraine. So they came out of this enormously repressive Tsarist regime in which violent anti-Semitism was the actual policy of the state. And so Rosenberg came from a family which really didn't speak English. They knew Russian, they knew Yiddish. They hardly spoke English at all. And yet Rosenberg emerged almost immediately in early youth as a very great poet, and perhaps also a great painter, because his paintings are quite remarkable. And yet none of his poetry was published in book form while he was alive. It's only after his death that he became famous.
So this was a man who was from a poor Russian immigrant family in England. He was killed in action in the last year of the war, 1918,
yes.
And he was just 28 years old. And let me read I'm going to read six or eight lines from a poem.
Surely, I would enjoy that.
Isaac
please.
Rosenberg, and then we can talk about that. The wheels lurched over the sprawled dead, but pained them not, though their bones crunched. They left this dead with the older dead, stretched at the crossroads, burnt black by strange decay. Their sinister faces lie, the lid over each eye, and our wheels grazed his dead face. You couldn't write that without being there.
No. And also without that painter's instinct for the picture and the reality of something. Rosenberg was not only unlucky and poor, but also a very poor soldier. He never managed the all-important feat of looking like a soldier.
Yeah.
Which
your description of him really makes that clear. And his poetry really vividly depicts the grim and violent reality of the war. You said his poetry was expunged of patriotism, glory, and heroism. And when I read that, I thought, you know, England works very hard to have museums that don't glorify war. And it is an inclination of pop culture or whatever to kind of glorify war and simplify war. But it is, I think, a journalistic duty and a part of being a good, honest poet is to tell it straight.
Yes, I think so.
Michael Korda is the author of Muse of Fire, World War I, Seen Through the Lives of the Soldier Poets. As we've heard, Michael's father and uncles fought in the war. He tells their story in his 1979 book, Charmed Lives. Michael was born in the UK to British and Hungarian parents and served in the Royal Air Force. He was awarded the Order of Merit of the Republic of Hungary for his role in the 1956 Hungarian Revolution. Michael makes his home in the Hudson River Valley. Let's talk a little bit about how travelers, this is a travel show, by the way, let's talk a little bit about how travelers can take the inspiration they get from this poetry and incorporate it into their travels. What sites would you have us have on our list about World War I when we go to Britain, France, and Belgium?
Well, in England, I very strongly recommend seeing the Imperial War Museum, which is quite extraordinary and actually has a simulated trench, which will give you the entire experience of what it was like to be in a trench in the First World War. In addition to some magnificent paintings.
Let me underline that, Michael, because that is one of my favorite sites and one of the most underrated sites in London, the Imperial
Indeed.
War Museum. And war is a big part of the British heritage, and this tells it from a very human, unglorified point of view in a way that anybody can embrace and be inspired by.
Yes, I think that that's absolutely true. It's an awesome experience. There is also in Chelsea, though fewer people visit it, the Museum of the British Army, and has a marvelous collection both of paintings and other things. You know, there are these surprising things that you find in British museums occasionally, and that's one of them. I was very moved. I was in Oxford giving a speech about T. Lawrence. I wrote a biography of Lawrence of Arabia, and stopped into the Bodleian and was absolutely awestruck to find that in a glass case is T. Lawrence's robe and sandals and his headdress from those years that he spent organizing the Arab Revolt in 1917 and 1918. And there it was. It was in a very strange way, moving, because whoever would have guessed that it still existed
right.
and was on display. So, but the two museums you mentioned, I think, are extraordinary and well worth visiting.
You know, one thing that's not remembered is any firsthand experience in World War I now that it's more than 100 years ago. And when I'm in London, you know, right on the main drag between Big Ben and Trafalgar Square, you've got the Cenotaph. And this doesn't mean a lot to me because I'm not that tuned into World War I, but I get a sense that in Britain, to this day, 100 years later, the Cenotaph really is a powerful memorial to the people of Britain.
It is. It commemorates the dead of World War I. And certainly in Great Britain, November 11th is a very serious day. There are 2 minutes of silence beginning at 11 o'clock, which was when the Germans signed the armistice. But there, it's 2 minutes of national silence. Nothing moves, nothing sounds. There's 2 minutes of complete silence in commemoration of the First World War dead, and almost everybody wears, as I do, on that day, a red poppy in their lapel or in their hat.
And I've been there on that day, and it really is silent. People do respect that 2 minutes.
Oh, absolutely.
It'd be a hard time to grind our country to a halt on something that happened 100 years ago, but Britain certainly does. Michael, let's go to the continent now, and you've had a chance to pay attention to this and think about it and travel. In France and in Belgium, what are a couple of experiences, monuments, sites that you have found very compelling and inspiring?
Well, I think in Belgium, the 1914 battlefields, Mons and Ypres, are enormously moving and compelling. I think in France, though there's a wide range of things to see, that the most moving thing I know is the ossuaire filled with the bones of dead who could not be identified at the Battle of Verdun, which between French and German dead added up to, I think, over 1 million dead. And the Verdun battlefield and memorial is, I think, about as awesome as it gets.
And that's the proper use of the word awesome. I think people diminish that word by saying everything's awesome. If you want awesome, go to
this
Verdun.
This is awesome on a different scale.
You go to Verdun. And the bones of 1 million unidentified soldiers or whatever, I don't know the number, but it's an unimaginable amount in a building that seems to me as long as a football field. And it's surrounded by a sea of crosses and stars of David. And
Wow,
to be there, it is just awesome. Michael Korda has some 20 titles to his name. He's joining us on Travel with Rick Steves from New York City as we look at how poetry illuminates the realities of the First World War. His latest book is Muse of Fire, World War I, Seen Through the Lives of the Soldier Poets. Michael, let's talk again about a couple more poets in the time that we have remaining. You feature Robert Graves. Tell us a little bit about Robert Graves and why you've got him in your list of poets from World War I.
Well, I think Graves is one of the most significant poets, British poets at any rate, of World War I, and lived to a great old age. He wrote, I think, over 120 books, including I, Claudius, and Claudius the God, and was, even in old age, an impressive figure, about 6'2", with the build of an athlete and this shock of white hair. And his book, Goodbye to All That, is, I think, by any measure, probably the best memoir of a young infantry officer to come out of the First World War. It's always in print. It's constantly read. It's enormously moving and is quite literally a classic.
And here's four lines from Robert Graves. You smug-faced crowds with kindling eye, who cheer when soldier lads march by, sneak home and pray you'll never know the hell where youth and laughter go.
Yes.
My
yes.
Goodness. And then the way you describe these poets, middle-class, well-educated, physically fit, enthusiastic, brave, they signed up early in 1914. But he was a young man of great sensitivity and strong emotion, not at all the reckless daredevil he attempted to be. Well, this is a whole dimension of World War I that can inspire us today.
I think in every case, these people are enormously moving. I found Alan Seeger fascinating, partly because I didn't know that much about him, except for the fact that he was Pete Seeger's uncle.
Right.
But his roommates at Harvard with T.S. Eliot and John Reed, you could hardly imagine a more powerful threesome of young men than T.S. Eliot, John Reed, and Alan Seeger.
And these kids were privileged kids going to fancy colleges in the United States. They didn't really have to go to this war, but they...
No. Seeger wanted to. He joined the French Foreign Legion. There were several hundred Americans living in France who very much wanted to fight for France once the war broke out. But the difficulty was that joining the French army would deprive them of their American citizenship without making them French citizens. And the French, needless to say, found a solution to this problem by getting them to join the French Foreign Legion, since that's separate from the French army. So Seeger, who could easily have rode the war out and not gone to it at all, joined up in August 1914 with enormous enthusiasm.
So they moved all sorts of rules, and he did all sorts of heroics to be able to join the battle in order to be killed at the Battle of the Somme in 1916.
Killed at the Battle of the Somme.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Michael Korda. His book is Muse of Fire, World War I as Seen Through the Lives of the Soldier Poets. Michael, it's been such a delight to be able to talk to you and to be inspired by your work. And I would imagine when you put this much work into something about something that happened 100 years ago, you're thinking about what is the takeaway for today? What are your thoughts about that? Some parting thoughts on the world and poetry and war and peace?
Well, first of all, it's not so unusual for poetry to define a war. When you think about it, all we know about the Trojan War is the Iliad and the Odyssey, two poems. So the ability of poets to encapsulate and describe a war goes back for many, many hundreds of years, if not thousands. Secondly, if the First World War illustrates anything at all, is that war seldom settles anything. There is no such thing as a war to end war. Each war is only a step towards another. And that's borne out in so many ways by the futility of the First World War and by the lives and deaths of the First World War poets.
I think 100 years from now, they might look back and call World War I and World War II a continuation of the same war.
Exactly so.
Now, what about Ukraine? I would imagine you can look at Ukraine today and think, wow, 110 years earlier is something remarkably similar.
Yes, very much so. Very much. Of course, we don't know how it will come out yet. And it's also being fought over much the same ground that was determined in Europe by the end of the First World War, the collapse of the Russian Empire, the fragility of the new nations, the impermeability of the frontiers that were established then one way or another, all of the problems that confronted the Allied powers in 1919 as they tried to make a peace settlement after the war are still haunting us today, and the Ukraine is a perfect example of that.
And Michael, think of the notion of a battle of attrition. I mean, that was a calculated thing in World War I. We will bash
Absolutely.
Our heads together. We will bash our heads together and take unprecedented losses. But we calculate that the enemy will bleed white and drop first.
Indeed. And officers and generals were severely reprimanded for not having sufficient casualties.
Right. And then the tonnage of artillery 110 years ago and the tonnage of artillery today.
Well, you know, I'd like to say, above all, that despite all the manifold and extraordinary things that have changed warfare, that the war in the Ukraine exactly mirrors a smaller version of the First World War. It's hard to believe that over 100 years since the First World War, people are still digging trenches and living in them. And that victory of the war depends on immense artillery barrages, not of hundreds of thousands, but of millions of shells. It's as if the spirit of the First World War is still with us.
But Michael, where are the poets today?
I don't know. I would like to see them. I wish I spoke or understood Ukrainian. Perhaps I would be able to read their poetry. But I'm sure it exists, and I'm sure that will always be the case.
Michael Korda, such a beautiful conversation, celebrating the poets who can help us learn from history. Thanks for your book, Muse of Fire, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We have web links to Michael Korda's work in the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Advice for getting off the busy tourist trails in Turkey and visiting some of its rural villages. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. We're at 877-333-RICK or email us at radio@ricksteves.com.